Hi, I'm Elise.
I'm Matt, and welcome to Pod Race, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. If this is your first time joining us, we're two friends watching Star Trek Deep Space Nine and sharing both our deep and irreverent thoughts on our favorite Star Trek series.
This week, we're talking about Season 5, Episode 14, In Purgatory's Shadow. Teleplay by Ira Stephen Bear and Robert Hewitt Wolf. We haven't seen those two names together in a while. And directed by Gabrielle Beaumont. In Purgatory's Shadow aired on February 10th, 1997.
This week on Deep Space Nine, Garak and Worf investigate a message with Garak and Worf investigate a message which suggests that Cardassian spymaster Nobrin Tane is still alive. Upon their arrival, they not only do they find Tane, but also General Martok and someone else they did not expect. All right, so Elise, did you or did you not remember this episode?
I actually did not remember this episode. I do remember from being told that the Bashir part of this episode happens, but I didn't actually remember the episode. That being said, like, that worked in my advantage because it was wonderful.
Right.
Before we get into it real quick, I do want to say, if you have rewatched this episode, you may have noticed that this episode is dedicated to Derek Garth, who was killed in a car crash on the way to work while they were working on this episode.
Yeah, and Derek was a grip that worked on the show and who Ira said was, like, the most positive person on the set. So
that's really awful. On a lighter and better note, I definitely found it... That was a horrible transition. I found it... Because so this episode is a to-be-continued, and I definitely felt... I had a struggle to not continue watching the next episode because this episode was so action-packed and I had such a great time with it.
Yeah, it's like we're really cooking with... The show is really like cooking with gas now. And like this is right around, you know, I would have been 10 turning 11 later that year at the time when like I really started becoming like... DS9 obsessed and like really, really kind of getting into DS9 and like watching it, making sure I was watching it weekly and everything else. Part of that's just like, you know, aging and having like a little more like agency over your media diet. But, you know, all this action oriented stuff is really what like, you know, grabs a 10-year-old. So you come for that and then you stay, you know, 30 years later for the, philosophy and the politics and the morality discussions that we have on this podcast, as well as the thirst.
That makes sense. I was too busy being a 15-year-old asshole when this aired. Sorry, I was about to be 15. I was very excited to see J.G. Hertzler's name in the opening credits. It didn't occur to me while watching this, but... I was reading, and it also makes sense based on some things that Martok said. This is really the first time we've ever met the real Martok. The Martok in the Way of the Warrior was already a changeling because Martok says he's been in this internment camp for 2 years, and that was about a year and a half ago. So that's really, I found that really interesting. Similarly, I feel like it doesn't make sense for us to pretend the entire time that Bashir at Deep Space Nine is Bashir. So we do know now that Dr. Bashir that we've been seeing in the last few episodes is actually a changeling stand-in for our beloved. When I refer to the changeling version of Bashir, I'm just going to call him not Bashir.
Ah, yes, the baby Sinclair. Approach to determining who and who isn't a character.
Exactly. I was gonna say like not the daddy. Bashir's not really a daddy though. Bashir's baby.
So speaking of, you know, the discovery that Bashir is also in this internment camp and has been for about a month. Bashir is wearing, as you will call, the old uniforms, the pre-First Contact uniforms, which continuity-wise would have placed his kidnapping sometime around the Ascent. So was that 3 or 4 episodes ago? Something like that. Right. And, well, folks might remember, and I can't remember if I alluded to this on air when we were talking about
probably because I remember a couple times where you were like, nope, not going to talk about that, and I had a few, and like I don't remember specifically what we were talking about, but I feel like it was because of this.
Yeah, 100% it was, because you can tell because of the uniform change.
Yep.
That is not Bashir who is in the infirmary and stuff in that episode, kind of retroactively.
Yes.
So when he's really pushing for Jake and Cassidy to convince Ben to do the treatments that stop the vision, is that him being a good fake doctor? Or is right. that him as the changeling saying, oh, there's some weird shit going on here. We need to, like, you know, do yeah. whatever.
Yep.
In the eye of the beholder. Because it probably yeah. wasn't written that way intentionally, but retroactively, right?
Right. It works. One last thing I want to, because we'll get into that a little bit more when we get to the revelation. This episode originally was going to be about Michael Eddington, and it was going to be inspired by the movie The Great Escape, which I have not seen. But recently, my roommates and I have created what we call the list. And it is a list of films that we like a lot that at least one of us has not seen. And we do a random number generator usually and pick a movie to watch from the list. We are allowed veto. So, like, if we were not in the mood for something serious, we could skip a movie or something like that. But anyway, The Great Escape is on that list, and I look forward to watching it. The reason they didn't continue with that premise for this episode is they weren't sure that people liked Eddington enough for him to, like, carry an episode like that. And I have no comment on whether people like Michael Eddington enough for that to have worked, but this episode is so much more impactful than that would have been. And I think it's something that needed to happen in this show to continue the Dominion War stories that are going to come, which I don't think it's a spoiler to say. We're getting more into the Dominion fighting our friends.
Escalating the Cold War. The Cold War maybe becoming heating up, one. As they
yes,
say.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, man, it's a hot one.
So I'm glad that they decided not to do it on Eddington.
I don't disagree with you. I personally think the idea of doing like a Great Escape where like basically the Federation are the air quotes like bad guys right. in that context, especially with how we've talked about the Maquis and kind of, you know, mm-hmm. portraying the Maquis and things like that would have been interesting. But
I agree. I think if they could have done both, it would have been fine. I just think that if we only get one of the two, I'm preferable to what we got.
Well, yeah, and this is really, like you say, it's really important for the idea of, like, it gets back to, like, the changeling threat, which, you know, was revealed that the Martok changeling in Apocalypse Rising, which opened the season, and then it's, again, it kind of, we fully, like, put that whole somewhat forced by the studio, like, Klingon conflict of last season, and now we're kind of, we're putting things back on the rails in terms of the, like, growing Dominion threat, so I think it functionally works that way really well. And yeah, I don't know how much like Eddington as like the star, as like Steve McQueen in The Great Escape would or wouldn't have worked to have been received by the audience in a lot of ways, like just picking another Maquis character. If it had been Rolaren, okay, maybe, but you're probably not bringing Michelle Forbes back for one episode where you haven't seen her at all in Deep Space Nine before, and she turned down being on Deep Space Nine and,
yeah.
you know, probably couldn't afford whatever she wanted. Like, or, like, you know, something like that. It's kind of like, oh, what was it? There was an episode of Deep Space Nine. I can't remember if we've seen it before or not yet. Oh, no. Yeah, it was. It was the Thomas Riker episode.
Yeah.
Where, like, I think at one point they're talking about having like Encinito from Lower Decks, like the TNG mm-hmm. Lower Decks,
yep.
missing, presumed dead. They're like, yes. we're thinking of maybe like her, it was a prison break sort of thing with her, but Yeah. So
I do remember
TLDR,
that. Yeah.
I hear you.
Yeah, I remember that. I don't know that I think that this episode really has an A plot and a B plot, because it's more like the stuff that's happening on Deep Space Nine is very much related to what's happening in the Gamma Quadrant, but I still separated it so we can kind of have our Garak, Zial, Dukat, Kira conversation, then we can talk about Deep Space Nine, and then we can talk about, you know, the Gamma Quadrant. Does that work for you?
Yeah, it does.
Sounds wonderful. Well, this episode opens with Kira helping Odo reorganize his quarters. This helps us remember that Odo is a changeling again. That happened two episodes ago. This does not really have anything to do with the plot besides placing the two characters within the episode. I will say, though, that Odo sliding off the bed because he becomes goo while sleeping makes me both laugh and pity him. Like, I'm like, oh, that's so pitiable. Like, Kira finds a romance self-help book that Odo is quite embarrassed about, and I just want to call out that basically the same scene happened in Gilmore Girls between Luke and Lorelai. So yeah, except Lorelai is much more of an asshole than Kira is, so she, like, was a dick about it.
I mean, that sounds right.
Yep. We learn that Zial and Garak have been spending a lot of time together, and she keeps trying to admit her feelings for Garak, like, throughout the first half of this episode, and Garak's very much like, can we just enjoy each other's company without making it a thing? And I watched this episode on Friday with some friends, and Tessa, who's been on this episode, was like, this definitely reads as a gay man not wanting to hear about, like, his best gay friend, his best straight lady friend, like, wanting more, like... It very much reads like that to me.
Yeah, no, for sure. I just, I've gone on, like, over, like, I think the course of my life, this whole, like, cycle on this Zial-Garak relationship of sorts. And, like, as time goes forward, we'll probably be, like, talking about it a little bit more. But this is Melanie Smith's first appearance playing Zial. Obviously,
is she our third Zial
before? She is our third and final Zial.
Yes.
And, like, each time they recast Zial, the actress is older. So, like, they're kind of more rapidly kind of, like, aging her up, I think. So it's, like, so this whole friendship
dynamic, so it's not Garak and a teenager?
Yeah. Right, functionally, right?
Yeah.
And... as Kira says, Zial's an adult and she can do what she pleases. And, like, we don't know exactly how old Garak is, but, like, the fact that Dukat and Garak are rivals, they read more as peers. And, like, but again, you don't want to, like, age gap shame, because, again, they are an adult and things like that. And maybe Cardassian, Bajoran, biracial, bispecial, like, folks, like, age faster, like,
right.
It probably ultimately doesn't matter, but I've gone on this whole, like, journey between, like, it's a problematic age gap to, like, you're removing ZL's agency to, like, blah blah blah, blah, right?
So I definitely just don't give a shit about their ages. I'm gonna just, like, I don't think I ever have. That being said, I do think I always assumed Garak was, like, a bit younger, not so young, not like 20 years younger than Dukat, but, like, I do think he's, like, maybe 7 years younger than him, 8 years younger than him. But that's, like, based on nothing. that's just based on my thought process. Or, like, my just assumptions I've made. But yeah, I agree. Like, obviously, Dukat and Garak have been peers, but, or, like, at least around the same, like, yeah, I don't know. I just don't care about the ages. I do think it won't work because Garak is gay, but that's a different issue. So Dukat pops up in this episode and he is furious to find out that Zial and Garak have been hanging out. And it seems very clear to me that his issue is not their ages as much as the fact that Garak is, like, a bad person in his mind. Like, he and Garak just don't like each other for reasons that the show has showed us already. But I do want to talk about how Ducat reacts about this towards Kira and how he reacts about it towards Zial. I mean, obviously he tells Garrick, like, if you touch her, I will kill you, basically. I mean, he doesn't say that, but, like, he says that, you know? And you had said this already, but, like, Kira is very much like, Zial's an adult, she could do what she wants. But he's yelling at Kira, like, this is her fault, she should have been the one to stop this. And I think that there's a fundamental difference in what Kira meant when she said, like, she can come with me on Deep Space Nine and I will take care of her, versus what Ducat thought that meant. And Ducat thought that meant, like, be a parent to her, like she's a child. And Kira meant, like, I'm going to make sure she has her basic needs and also that she, like, fits in and, like, has a good time here.
But she's not a soldier in your private little war against the Klingons with your stolen bird of prey or captured bird of prey or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think that Kira and Ducat would never have had the same idea of what taking care of Zial meant.
Right.
And I obviously agree, you know, like, I'm not a fascist, so, like, Kira's idea of, like, taking care of Zial makes a lot more sense to me. Zial is an adult, and, like, it's really nice that Kira has, like, helped her make a home for herself there, and that's really great. Ducat treats Zial like she's a little child. He's completely unfair with her. He talks down to her. It comes from a weird place because, like, he talks to her like he would talk to anyone else when he was, like, in, like, any, like, military, like, someone that was under him in the military, like, giving an order rather than, like, having a conversation. And I'm not saying that that is ever a good way to parent someone, but it comes off even weirder because, like, this is not the man who raised Zial, like...
Yeah.
I don't think any dad should be talking to their daughter that way, but, like, it doesn't work even more because he was not there when she was a child. But, yeah, I just think it's very weird. And, like, he's obviously prejudiced against her Bajoran side. I mean, he definitely says, like, I don't like her Bajoran beliefs, but at least I understand that because it's part of who she is. And I'm just, like... Doesn't it make sense that someone who's half Cardassian would be somewhat interested in hanging out with the only other Cardassian person on this station? Like, that makes sense to me. In any case, I was just really proud of Zial for standing her ground with Ducat and being like, no, I'm not leaving here to go to Cardassia. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. That, yeah, no, totally agree. Well, and here's the other thing, too. If it had been a different day and, like, he wasn't more pissed about the whole Garrick thing, he probably wouldn't have, like, been as, like, that's her heritage. It's fine.
Yeah.
I'm pissed about it. Like, you know what I mean?
He would be he'd be angry about the fact that she, like, did Bajoran things. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Right? So.
Yeah. So, to get to the main, that was just a little... I did want to talk about, like, that family dynamic stuff before we get into the main plot of the episode.
Look at you laying track.
I'm such a professional. Mm-hmm. So, I want to start off by talking about, like, what occurs on Deep Space Nine. So, we will be going a little bit back and forth, and then we'll talk about, like, what happens in the Gamma Quadrant. So, it may be a little bit of retreading this way, but that's all right. So, Garrick is enlisted to decode a Cardassian transmission from a Gamma Quadrant listening post, and then downplays the significance of this message. And he's, like, seen having, like, a meal or whatever, or drinks with, like, not Bashir and Zial, which I think is really cute that he has been hanging out with both of these people together. I like that. It's like a little friend group, even though, obviously, they don't know it's not Bashir. And he had previously talked to both of these people about the Cardassian Romulan attack fleet that was lost in the Gamma Quadrant. So, like, it's surprising to them that he's not more interested in what's happening here. Like, it could be people from that lost fleet. Mm-hmm. Not Bashir pretty much immediately knows that Garrick is full of shit and intends to check out the situation because Garrick is like about to steal a runabout and Nott Bashir is just like there with a phaser at him. And then it's interesting because to keep up the ruse, Nott Bashir is like, let's go talk to Sisko about this before you leave. And then Garrick finally admits that the transmission is a distress call from Enebran Tane, the former head of the Obsidian Order. They were very close. We've met him before. He's played by Paul Dooley, aka Angela Chase's grandfather. Was this his second episode?
Technically speaking, it was the fourth. Oh, right? So there was Wire. There was The Wire, the first one where he's introduced. Mm-hmm. There was the two-parter, like the die is cast and
yes okay okay was, I
which
forgotten.
Was where they attack the Sidi Nor Tel Shiar like double thing and then this episode
that makes sense. And Sisko's like, okay, you can go on this mission to the Gamma Quadrant, but only if Worf joins you, which to me is great because I don't really remember us getting like a Worf Garrick stuff before this.
Yeah, they're not characters that are often paired together.
Yeah. We cut to a scene where Dax is, like, furious at Worf that he's going on this mission and did not tell her. And, like, Worf throws some nonsense about a warrior doesn't have to tell blah, 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 his blah, blah, blah plans. And I'm just like, shut up, Worf. I do think this scene is kind of hot, though, because Dax is like, I'm just here to borrow your Klingon operas to listen to while you're gone. And I totally, like... just seems like she's like, I'm just here to grab that sex toy we used to use while you're gone. Like, to make him wanting more and that he's going to be missing out. And I know I read a lot into that scene and then none of that is what's happening. But in my mind, that's where it goes. I think Worf's just angry and, like, worried she's going to, like, lose his operas.
I know, it's kind of cute.
It's funny to me because there's like certain people I just like would not lend a book or a movie to, and this feels like Dax is someone that is not trustworthy with lending things to. And that feels like a character trait of Dax's that makes a lot of sense to me. Later, Deep Space Nine gets a distress call from Worf. It's not really clear, but basically he's warning them that the Dominion is getting ready to invade. And so Deep Space Nine goes on yellow alert. And Sisko tells Dax she needs to go tell Starfleet, like, what's going on. Sisko sends Kira and the Defiant to the Gamma Quadrant to find Worf. And they, like, find that more listening posts have been destroyed. And they don't stay in the Gamma Quadrant that long. Shit's fucked up. So they return. This is kind of crazy to me. I had forgotten that they decided that the only way to fix this is to seal the wormhole kind of indefinitely. I didn't know that I forgot they could even do that. I'm laughing at Kira for, like, being so upset about this. Like, what about Bajor and the prophets? And it's just like, okay, I get that you're religious, but, like, people are going to die. Like, what's wrong with you? So of course Sisko has to reassure her and be like, oh no, there's some technobabble reason why the prophets will just be fine, and don't worry, anytime they've ever needed to talk to someone on Bajor, they've been able to, so blah blah blah, it'll be great.
All true.
I really think it's funny that Kira was, like, so upset about the wormhole being sealed and, like, didn't realize or didn't think about the fact that, like, if the Dominion does come through, Bajor's going to be, like, the first hit because they're literally right there. So Sisko reminds her of that as well.
Yeah.
So that is really all that happens on Deep Space Nine until, like, the ending. But I feel, like, weird talking about the ending of this episode without talking about what happens in the Gamma Quadrant first. So Garrick and Worf are, like, setting off to go find the source of this message. And they see, like, a bunch of Dominion folks. And they're, like, or they realize that they have to, like, go through Dominion space to, like, get to where they're going. So instead of trying to cloak and chat their way through. I mean, they're on a runabout. I don't think they can be cloaked. But, like, instead of doing a Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, like, bad tense of Klingon, like, Uhura trying to, like, get through Klingon space, they decide to, like, go through this nebula. But, like, a huge fleet shows up anyway. So, like, their plan basically...
shows up. They're already hiding in it, I think.
But, like, their plan basically fails because they tried to, like, avoid going past all the Dominion people, and they, like, are there anyway. So they get caught in a tractor beam and are boarded by Jem'Hadar soldiers. I do want to say, this is not related to this episode, but I just, yesterday, finished the novelization of Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. And I wanted to tell you that that scene that I just referenced, where Uhura is trying to, like, thumb through the dictionary to, like, get through the Klingon space. In the book, it's told from the Klingon perspective.
Oh, that's funny.
It was so funny because it's, like, literally this guy who's on this, like, outpost, and he hates his job, and he, like, does not give a shit about it. He's like, if something bad's gonna happen, someone else with more resources will fix it, basically. And so the Enterprise is cloaked, and Uhura's like, we're bringing things and supplies, like, and not in a good Klingon language. They call it Klingonese still back then. I don't know what they call it now. In any case, the guy is basically like, that's a bullshit excuse, but I'm going to let them through anyway. So, like, while in the movie you get the version where, like, they're like, oh, we just made it, we just escaped through, like, the other side in the book, it's just like they just don't care. That's why they got through. It was very amusing. Yes, exactly. And I love at the end where they're just like, ha ha ha, and the one woman's just like, everyone laugh. But yeah, I side note, that book was great, and actually had a lot more Klingon stuff than the movie, which made me really happy. So
good.
They are beamed inside a internment camp, which apparently there's no way out except for death. And guess who they see in the middle of a fight in the middle of this internment camp?
Martok himself.
General Martok, who had previously been replaced by a changeling imposter 2 years earlier.
Dun, dun, dun.
Bananas.
B-A-N-A-N-A-S.
Martok is literally... exactly. Martok's being used for, like, melee training, basically, for the Jem'Hadar, which is awful, because, like, he's probably exhausted. But we do find out that Enna Brentain is also there. So, and the two of them seem like they've been, like, waiting to be rescued. Tain looks not good and is about to die, but he was able to modify their life support system in the camp, and that's how the messages got out. It sounds all bananas to me, but that's fine. It's Star Trek. I don't ask too many questions. That's not true. I ask all the questions, but I'm okay with weird answers. I do love how they set this scene up for, like, Bashir to show up, because, like, Worf and Garak are, like, talking to Martok, and this, like, other prisoner comes in, is like, he's out of isolation, but they obviously, like, don't say the name of who he is. And then Worf's like, who? And then Martok is like, a friend. And then in comes the real Dr. Julian Bashir, wearing the previous Deep Space Nine uniform, as mentioned earlier. It's, like, so, I found it so relieving that they found Bashir, which is so funny because, like, in the episode at this point you don't know that he's missing.
Yeah,
but I still felt relief
that you knew, that you trusted everyone does, who it was, like who the, like, friend was. It was, like, part of the gang.
Well, I mean, once they did the blood screenings, they, like, did but I was laughing. I'm laughing, like, where did these blood screenings come from? Like, who brought them? I don't, like, maybe Bashir cooked one up. I don't know. In any case, Bashir explains that he went to sleep after a conference a month ago and woke up in this camp. And I was hysterical at the idea that he, like, fell asleep with his uniform on, I guess. Mm.
Must have been really tired.
Yes, exactly. And Martok is like, basically the same thing happened to me. I was abducted on Kronos. And Martok talks about how upset and angry he is about all the Klingons that died because of his changeling double. And I'm glad that they mentioned that, because it obviously shows that there's some sort of information coming through. Like, Martok, it wasn't unaware that that had all happened. So I do think, like, the rumor mill has probably been spinning in this internment camp.
Yeah, and even, like, Julian coming in, he would have more recent information to share and stuff, right?
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. The fact that Julian had been there, you know, 23 months less than Martok. So obviously he had a lot of information to catch him up on. So obviously the next step is for Worf to try to get the information back to Sisko that the Bashir on the station is really a not Bashir. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I watched Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey last night. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie.
I have never seen a Bill or a Ted.
Oh, I think that you should rectify that. But can I tell you the plot of Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey?
Yeah, of course.
So this guy played by Hans, the guy from the Mighty Ducks, like the hockey guy that like...
Yeah.
Yeah. Hans looks basically like Baron Harkonnen in the future and wants to kill Bill and Ted and creates an evil robot of each of them and sends them to the past to kill the original Bill and Ted.
Makes sense.
So throughout the movie, Bill and Ted kept saying, like, Bill and Ted are, like, a unit. Like, they are, like, as Tessa said, they are soulmates. They both have girlfriends, but, like, we do think that they're a committed, like, foursome. In any case, they kept saying the evil us's, and every time, like, it just felt, like, similar to this. Like Bashir would call, like, the changeling version of himself, like, the evil Bashir, the evil me, or whatever. The evil us's.
So
good. I thought it was... After that, hospice worker Martok, joke because he, like, apparently knows when Tane is about to die and is like, Garrick, you should probably say your goodbyes now. That comment is based on actual, like, lived experience that I have. Like my grandmother's hospice worker, like, knew when my grandmother was about to die and was able to, like, have my aunt. My mom and my uncle, like, be with her when it happened. And hospice workers are wonderful. But it is just really funny that he phrased it that way. And I'm like, did he become a medic? Like, what? The Klingons have all sorts of skills.
Martok's a complicated guy. It's multidimensional, multifaceted.
This was one of my favorite scenes of the episode. The scene with Garrick and a dying Tane. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Garrick, like, Tane is blind and cannot see, and so he's really, like, disoriented because he's also dying. And Garrick reassures Tane that all of their enemies have been taken care of. It's just, like, really, really reassuring him that it's okay for him to die because his work's done. And I just felt that was so sweet of Garrick to say it to him. And then Garrick suddenly calls Tane father and asks him to finally admit that they are father and son. And I had forgotten that happened. And Tane admits it by being like, I should have killed you.
Yeah.
but in the end, Tane tells Garrick that he's proud of him. And it's just really nice. I put the holding back tears emoji in the notes. For our listeners who are not reading our notes.
I really like that scene as well. It's probably actually one of my, like, favorites in the episode. And, like,
Yeah.
Yeah, Garrick lies to Tane one last time about not being about, you know, him being alone because he can't see that Bashir's there hanging out in the corner. But the way Garrick looked back, said, yes, we're alone, then looked back at Julian, it was, like, really clear that for these final moments, it was important to Garrick to have someone witness it and witness that admission of Tane, finally affirming what Garrick knew the whole time. And,
yeah.
Wanted, like, and it's this that it was Julian there to witness it too, I thought was, yeah. I guess, yeah, it was special. It was important. It was like, well, yeah, right?
I know. I'm glad it wasn't fake Bashir.
Yeah.
Because that would have been sad.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. And I can't remember the author's name right now, but the idea to make Tane the. Make Garrick the illegitimate child of Tane was an author of like was the suggestion of an author of the Star Trek novels, and had mentioned it a couple of years prior to Robert Hewitt Wolf, and so Robert sent her a letter saying, hey, we're going to use your idea, thank you so much, and enclosed like $1,000 check with it or something like that for the idea.
Oh, that's really nice. I have no idea how much ideas should cost, but it's nice that they gave that person something.
Yeah. So.
So this is basically the end of that part of the episode, because we're at this situation where Deep Space Nine knows the wormhole needs to be sealed, and Garrick and Worf have come to the Gamma Quadrant and gotten what they needed. And found two friends that they need to help bring home. So the ending of this episode is really interesting, because Deep Space Nine is like trying to seal the wormhole, even though they know that Worf and Garrick are going to be stuck in the Gamma Quadrant. But techno thing fails to seal the wormhole, which I assume was the non-Bashir's.
Yeah.
Mission sabotage. Was to like fuck that up. Mm-hmm. Listen, all y'all, there's always a sabotage.
Sabotage.
And a huge Dominion fleet enters the Alpha Quadrant through the wormhole, and that is how we end this episode. And then we get a big to be continued screen, which was like taunting me. So yeah. Oh, I wanted to say one more thing. I thought about this when I was watching the episode, but didn't write it down. Julian seems way more with it than I would be if I was a prisoner, especially one that just came out of isolation.
Yeah.
For a month. I mean, I don't think he was in isolation that whole time, but he just seems like his hair's grown out, but he's like seems clean enough, you know?
Right.
Yeah, it was a really good episode. I can't wait to watch and talk about the second half of it.
Yeah, should be good. Yeah. What's gonna happen? I don't know.
I actually don't remember how it all plays out, so I'm really excited.
In the meantime, Elise, it's time for the Altair Water Thirst Quencher. Altair Water first being mentioned in the context of Star Trek by Dr. McCoy ordering an Altair Water in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. Also a possible reference to Alta from Altair IV in the MGM movie Forbidden Planet, a.k.a. The Tempest in Space. Elise, who are you thirsting for this week?
I'm first thirsting for the fan fiction I wrote in my brain about Worf and Dax. Do you have a thirst?
Not really this episode, no.
That's fair.
You've kind of already alluded to my most Star Trek thing, which was...
Oh, yes, please share it.
Well, you mentioned the idea of, you know, because Ron Moore used to do these AOL chats back in the day with fans, and he made the same reference about maybe Bashir just fell asleep in his uniform and blah, yes, blah, blah, blah. But this episode also mentions a recent Borg attack, which was intended to refer to the Battle of Sector 001 that we saw in First Contact. However, the stardate that they gave in the film, stardate 50893.5 is later than the start date given in the two-parter, which is start date 50564.2. And when asked about this inconsistency, Ron Moore commented in this AOL chat, quote, "I'm not at liberty to reveal the secret messages contained within these seemingly," quotes, "mistaken star dates, but rest assured there's another brilliantly conceived and skillfully executed Star Trek moment brought to you by the people who wrote Meridian."
That's really funny. I have never once understood a star date and am not trying to now. So I think that's a really funny answer from Ronald Moore.
Yeah.
My most Star Trek thing was something that I learned after watching the episode. I did not learn it while watching the episode, as it was not obvious to me. But the nebula in this episode was actually one of the background plates of the one of the nebulas from the Wrath of Khan. They recolored it and flipped it. And so my most Star Trek thing is just reusing set pieces.
Yeah, I didn't even catch that. That's such a good catch, dude. That's like literally the most Star Trek thing.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't catch it either. I cheated and looked it up. But yeah. Was there anything else you wanted to add about this episode before we sign off?
No, I just can't wait for next week.
Same, same, same.
All right. Elise, until next time, where can folks find more of you on the internet?
You can find me on Blue Sky, Letterboxd, and Storygraph at, I don't know why I said Storygraph, like,
Storygraph.
At Chicken Tendy.
I'm Ron Burgundy.
T-E-N-D-I. You can find my other podcast, Fang Bangers Pod, on Blue Sky and Instagram at Fang Bangers Pod. That's bangers with a Z or Z, as well as anywhere you listen to podcast. Yeah.
Awesome. You can catch me on Blue Sky and Letterboxd at Maddie Hugh, MattyHugh. You can also catch us together on Blue Sky and Instagram at PodRace, and you can email us at podrace@gmail.com.
Please remember to rate and review us on the podcatching system of your choice. Thank you again to our editor, Melissa, and DJ Empirical for our interstellar theme song.
And until next time, computer and program.
Bye.